Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 115 of the Writership Podcast. Today, we're talking about motivation reaction units. I'm Leslie Watts, here with fiction editor Kim Kessler, who is also the author of the upcoming novel, According to Plan. To learn more about the podcast, visit writership.com/podcast.
As you know, the podcast is sponsored by Jim Kukral from the Author Marketing Club. Jim just launched his new service for authors called Happy Book Reviews. We all know that books with more high-quality reviews sell more copies. HappyBookReviews.com is a service where Jim hopes to make your book happy with reviews. Check out the options at www.happybookreviews.com because nobody likes a sad book. You can make your book happy with reviews.
Hello, Kim. Welcome.
Hi, Leslie.
I'm so glad to have you here. Just as a reminder, Clark is taking a break, and so I'm having some friends come on and do the show with me. And Kim, I met at the Story Grid workshop in New York in February, and we've been talking and hanging out since then. And then went to the Story Grid editor certification course.
Yes.
And last month, and we've been talking story a lot.
Yes, it's so wonderful to meet fellow story nerds and connect on that level and be able to, just so much growth, so much opportunity. I thank you so much for letting me come on and talk story with you. It's my favorite thing. It's so great.
Awesome. Thank you. And if anybody wants to find out more about Kim and also According to Plan, then you can visit Kim's website at www.kimberkessler.com. That's KimberKessler.com.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. And as a reminder, the Pay What You Can promo for Clark's course is the Advanced Novel Writing with Harry Potter is still available for a limited time. So if you want to show your support for Clark and get a great course with bonuses to improve your writing in the bargain, then visit thebookeditorshow.com/Potter. So, okay. Awesome. Do you have a quote for us this week?
I do. So the quote is from Randy Ingermanson, and the quote is, you will write your MRUs by alternating between what your POV character sees, the motivation, and what he does, the reaction. This is supremely important. Remember that Swain, he's speaking of Dwight Swain here, remember that Swain calls these things motivation reaction units. The motivation is objective, but it is something that your character can see or hear or smell or taste or feel. You will write this in such a way that your reader also sees it, or hears it, or smells it, or tastes it, or feels it. You will then start a new paragraph in which your POV character does one or more things in reaction to the motivation. There is an exact sequence you must follow in writing your reaction. The sequence is based on what is physiologically possible. Note that the motivation is external and objective, and the reaction is internal and subjective. If you do this, you create in your reader the powerful illusion that he or she is experiencing something real. Now let's break this down into some more detail.
Which, of course, we will do. I love this quote. I love this. If the stories we tell make the book and the writing and all of that disappear so that they are simply having an experience, then that's the pinnacle of success.
Right. What I love about this quote and about MRUs and just this whole, tool that you can use when you're writing and especially when you're trying to write deep POV is that it's so practical and it's applicable and anyone can do it. I think a lot of the times It's you know, people feel like, oh, you know, how do I write deeper point of view? What do I do? What does it take? You know, and you can feel it when you read something. You're like, oh, that feels so good. I'm right there with them. And you can feel it when it's missing. But this is one of those really practical things you can apply that you can actually step through. And the same, you know, that's why we love the story grid, right? It's very practical things that you can mm-hmm. actually look and see, you know, why a scene's working or why your global story is working or not working. And this is the same thing. This is kind of going all the way down to the beat level of looking at why maybe I'm not really very sympathetic to this character. Why? Or I don't know. I don't really believe it, or I'm not really bought in. And that sometimes goes all the way down to that beat level with the POV and going through these MRUs, these motivation reaction units. And I just love how practical it is and how I can actually apply it to, you know, my stories and to stories that I'm editing. So it's a great tool.
Yeah, yeah. And just for anybody who's not familiar with what we mean by beats in this context, so we're talking about Yeah, if you have your global story, right, the mm-hmm. whole thing, within the global story, you have the acts. And like mm-hmm. we mentioned last week that you have beneath the acts, you have sequences. Within sequences, you have scenes. So within scenes, you have beats, right?
Yes.
And the cool thing is, right, the five commandments of story, which, again, we talked about last week, that mm-hmm. you have an inciting incident, progressive complications, a crisis question, a climax, and a resolution, you have all of those things within each of these levels of story. Now, mm-hmm. getting down to the beat level, and, you know, you wouldn't necessarily want to analyze every, you know, you're not going to put the beat level five commandments of story in your story spreadsheet or anything like that. But what you want to do is to get down to that level often enough, you know, or long enough, practice it enough so that that becomes part of your vernacular, part of,
yes.
you know, not vernacular. That's not what I mean. What I mean is like it becomes part of your writing.
It's in your skill set that you just, it becomes more muscle memory, right? It becomes
right.
something that you can't help but do. And one thing I think is when a scene, you know, I guess once you have everything else worked out, your global story works, you know, your acts are working, your sequences are turning, your scenes are turning, you kind of have everything figured out and you're ready to take your story to that next level. Mm-hmm. That's when you kind of get to this level about, you know, making sure your emotional continuity of the scene makes sense. Your POV, you know, continuity makes sense. And you're on this deep level with whatever you're looking to do, you know, well, I guess we'll talk about narrative distance, but definitely a way that you can take that story to that next level and really, really enhance the reader experience and really, you know, make the, when it comes to like things like word choice or when it comes to, you know, what you're going to tell the reader, what you're going to show the reader, you run it through this POV lens, which is this MRU experience, right? It's this thing that, there's this trigger that happens and then the character is going to react to it. And every character is going to be different. And so if you're looking at POV, it really comes down to the character and what they're experiencing and how, what words you're using in what order to portray that to the reader. And so you just, it gives you something, a reason to make choices and a mm-hmm. lens to put things through. So things aren't arbitrary, right? Nothing
right.
about your writing is arbitrary. Nothing about the words you use are arbitrary. Everything has a reason and it's intentional. And this is that the same way, you know, that we talk about, well, what scenes do I put in my book? Well, you got to show, you know, there's an order and there's a logic to what you're telling us in which order. And the same thing when it comes down to this beat level, sentence by sentence structure of a conversation or, of, you know, a scene, you know, that's happening. You have a reason to put one thing before the other because you're creating that reader experience through the character's deep POV.
So, yeah, totally. Okay, so we have a great submission to talk about this week for this because the author was going back and forth on what, you know, what POV should I do? And that was the initial question. And so she sent the same scene in both third person and first person. So we got to look at it really closely. And so, and then we'll talk about it today. So today's submission is called Passage, and the author is S. Thies. It's a fantasy/women's novel. The word count is 55,000, and this is the beginning of the novel. And Kim is going to read the third person version of this scene.
All right, here we go. Abby Murphy's fingers reached for the pendant, that god-awful chunk of wood that clung to her, cut her, stole her blood, and completely changed her life. She still didn't understand how it brought her there, to those islands, those people, and those magnificent creatures. All she knew for sure is that it brought her on a journey all the way back to the core of herself, before she fell in love with the wrong man, years before she started smoking and guzzling wine regularly, and long before mounting moments of self-doubt consumed her, leaving her feeling completely lost. Several months earlier, in a swanky LA restaurant smack dab in the center of Santa Monica Promenade, Abby was attempting to get through her shift without thinking about Nick, the man who dumped her just 3 days ago for another woman and gave her 1 week to move out of his apartment. She waited through tables, smiling and nodding to endless fingers signaling for another drink or check. Her manager signals that she was cut, done taking tables now, and shot condescending glances from across the dining room while sipping various ports at the bar with moneyed up yuppies. Abby dropped off her last table's check, pushed through the back door, and reached for the pack of cigarettes in her apron pocket. She pulled an old milk crate near the ginormous ashtray and sat down opposite Macy, who was counting her tips in the cool night air. Packing her cigarettes, she pulled one out, hands trembling, and lit the damn thing. Abby breathed in the nicotine and then exhaled, smooth and slow, as if she'd just had the best sex of her life, watching the smoke fold and collapse into the smoggy abyss. "I thought you quit," said Macy, wiping her hands on her apron. "Can I bum one?" "I did," Abby replied, and handed her 3 cigarettes. "Thanks, I'll take them. I'm barely getting any shifts here lately, and we're still waiting to hear if Terrell gets the job in Atlanta. It's a big move, but if we ever have kids, we'll be living right alongside his parents, for better or worse." Maggie winked and lit a cigarette. "Look, Abby, I'm the last person to judge, but it pisses me off to see you give in to smoking again just because he broke up with you. I told you Nick was a player." Abby took another long drag of the cigarette, blew softly, and replied, "He asked me to move in with him last year. Not everybody's like you, Abby. Not everybody takes moving in together to mean anything more than shacking up. It's cheaper than the gas it takes to commute across LA every day. Girl, you gotta let go of some of that small town Midwest in you." Macy tilted her head to find Abby's eyes and softly said, "I'll come by tomorrow and we'll get the rest of your stuff out of there. Then you can stay with us until you find something else, okay? Thanks, Macy." Abby took one last drag of the cigarette and pushed it hard into the ashtray. Hazy morning light streamed through the living room window, warming Abby, who had crashed on the sofa again last night. She couldn't bring herself to sleep in his bed anymore. Even though Nick was out of town for work, Abby hated being there. Everything seemed dirty. Even the stained glass bowl that they bought at an art fair together now appeared dusty and garish. Abby stared at the bowl and wondered, did she ever notice it? Did she ever touch it? Who was she, anyhow? And how long had she been dating Nick behind my back? Abby thought about hurling it across the room, the glorious smash that would sound, the pieces flying everywhere. Would he even feel anything if he stepped on my broken glass? What kind of man just up and leaves his girlfriend of 3 years for someone else? What kind of woman interferes with another relationship? Maybe she didn't know, though. Maybe he never told her. Maybe he just fell out of love with me. Abby pondered and squeezed the flab on her stomach. Maybe. The phone rang. Rubbing her eyes, Abby yawned and answered, "Hello?" "Hello, Abby," her mother said. "Where the hell are my cigarettes?" The sun shifted and Abby shivered. She walked across the steel-gray living room, checking the one and only console table in the sparse modern apartment. Her purse sat wilted on it, and she spied her cigarettes and lighter peeking out. "Now armored," Abby asked. "What's wrong?" Her mother rarely called, and when she did, it was usually to report something dreadful, like when the family dog Coco got hit by a truck and died in the street, or that she was no longer going to help Abby pay off her silly art school loans. Abby held her breath and listened hard to the phone, trying to hear over her rapidly beating heart. "Abby, your grandmother's died, and it seems, well, you're the only one she's left an inheritance for. You'll have to go to Florida, of course." "Abby?" Abby, are you there? Her mother asked. Yes, I just need a minute, Abby said. Well, you need to meet the trust attorney. You can meet him at the memorial service on Sunday. Sunday? Abby replied. I don't know if I can get my shift covered. Shit, what day was it? Heaven forbid you miss a shift. All that money on that fancy art school, and for what? A waitressing shift? Her mother chided. Abby, just go and let me know if I have to deal with any paperwork. You're not going? Why would I? It's not as if we were close. Abby, I must go. Good luck. Abby sat down slowly and pulled a throw pillow to her chest. How long had it been since she'd even called her grandma? How had she passed away? Her warm, gentle hands held Abby's during crackling lightning storms when she was little. She gave Abby warm milk with honey, patiently listening as Abby cried and despaired about her very first heartbreak in sixth grade. Well, everyone else patronized her. When Abby lost her dog, her grandma listened on the phone for over an hour. Her lungs tightened up, and Abby took a deep breath, but the tears took over her breathing, causing her to heave into uncontrollable sobs. She hugged the pillow and wept, drenching it with her tears for a good half hour, until her breathing slowed and finally, exhausted, fell quiet. Abby lit a cigarette and recalled the many years she spent at her grandma's home in Florida. Abby's mother suffered from bipolar depression and couldn't handle her full time after Abby's father died. Every school break that Abby could remember, she went to the little yellow cottage in the middle of the jungle near the wildlife refuge. Tall, tangled trees and thick masses of foliage grew over the first beds of foliage and moss. Hundreds of native animal species and far too many snakes made their home there and often crept near the cottage. Abby's lips curled when she remembered seeing panthers for the very first time, how she screamed and shrank behind her grandma. She felt awestruck by her grandma's bravery and her dedication to their survival. Her grandma's activism was just one of the reasons that made her the black sheep of the family. She was beautiful with soft, dark, elfin eyes and wavy chestnut hair that fell to her hips. Abby would sit on the floor behind her chair, braiding and twirling her grandma's hair as she gave tarot readings at the small card table that also served as the kitchen table. Her grandma read tarot cards and belly danced for a living, with a live snake writhing around her neck. She held bonfire parties in the clearing in their backyard, where musicians played guitars and violas, their glowing faces jubilant on those balmy nights. Abby could almost hear the hand drums, how she danced and swung with all those people around those flames that licked the treetops. Abby's grandpa was an artist who eventually left her grandma. He just disappeared one year, but no one ever talked about it. Abby remembered his gentle smile as he encouraged her to draw. They perched in the cool, shady treehouse where they drew for hours, the gentle lilac breezes refreshing them in the heat. Abby felt fresh tears roll down her cheeks as she reminisced these long, carefree days, filled with the encouraging words and love. Abby hugged the damp pillow and cried aloud. She glanced at Nick's aloof cat curled up in the corner. Even he wouldn't lift his head to witness her grief, wretched cat. Loud knocking interrupted Abby's reverie. Sniffing and wiping her eyes, Abby answered the door. Macy stood with two empty boxes. She looked at Abby's red, swollen, tear-drenched face. Damn, girl, what'd he do this time? My grandma died. Macy dropped the boxes and flung her soft brown arms around Abby. Oh my God, girl, I'm so sorry. Are you okay? Abby sniffed, ran her hand under her nose, and nodded yes. Macy stepped back, her hand tucked an unruly blonde hair behind Abby's ear, and said, girl, you've had one shitty week. Listen, lead me to the kitchen. I'm going to make us some lunch, and then we're going to raid that prick's liquor stash and make us some cocktails while we pack. Abby nodded her head, yes, wiped her eyes, and went to the kitchen. Macy made lunches, and Abby pulled out some orange juice and champagne. Were you close to your grandma? Macy asked. Yeah, I was. Closer to her than anyone. I think I should go to the memorial service, too. Do you think Dan will let me have a few days off? I know it's short notice. Abby, you've got to go to the memorial service. You've got to have closure. I'd be pissed as hell if you skipped out on my funeral. Just tell Dan you're going to take some time off. When you get back, if we're still in LA, you can crash on our couch till you find a new place. Abby handed her a mimosa and said, there's an inheritance. Said Macy, sipping her mimosa and swaying her hips. She winked and began singing, money, 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 money. I don't know yet, Abby said slowly. She ever really had much money. Sorry. You think it's her house? Macy asked. Would you keep it? God, I don't know. Jeez, Mace. I just found out. Besides, it's in Florida, she frowned. Well, hell, girl, if I were you, I'd be on a plane tomorrow and up in the in that trust lawyer's face to give me my inheritance. Cheers. They clinked their glasses, finished lunch, and packed up any last trace of Abby from the apartment. Abby took one last look around the apartment she had shared with the man she'd fallen in love with 3 years ago. She shook her head, glanced at the ugly glass bowl, tossed the keys onto the console table, and shut the door behind her. It's all over, just like that. Two boxes and a suitcase after 3 years, Abby said. And on to new adventures, Macy winked.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Sorry, I couldn't bring myself to sing the line.
No, that's okay. That's all right. That's all right.
I could hear it in my head. Hopefully the listeners could hear it too.
I'm sure. Yeah, so we have a really interesting setup here with, you know, when we talk about story and, you know, what stories are supposed to do, and they talk about change. And by golly, Abby is in for it with change because,
yes.
Right, she's lost her boyfriend, her live-in boyfriend of 3 years, mm-hmm. right? That's a big mm-hmm. change. And although that's already happened, she's going to be dealing with the aftermath and the, you know, of that. And then her, you know, what seems to be her favorite relative has okay. passed away as well. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, some sort of inheritance. We don't know what that will be exactly, but it promises to be something interesting because her grandma was kind of an interesting person.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and then there's, you know, potential conflict with her mom and mm-hmm. like, and so I just feel like Abby is going to get to figure out who she is underneath these mm-hmm. other people and their expectations and their ideas about who she is and what she should be doing. So we're in for a good, interesting, you know, complex tale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and definitely. And you can tell there's a few things, you know, like layered in here about, you know, she's waitressing. She went to this fancy art school. Mm-hmm. Her grandpa taught her how to draw, you know, but she's clearly not doing that. You know, she doesn't, mm-hmm. We haven't seen her do any art yet. We just know that that's something that she used to do. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, like you're saying, as she finds herself, what, you know, where that's going to come back around with these things that were planted in her as a young girl with her grandparents about, you know, clearly her grandma is the kind of person who is all about being yourself and doing things that you believe in and that you're passionate about. And it seems like she's kind of lost that. She doesn't really know who she is. And I don't think we do yet either. We don't really have a clear understanding of who Abby is. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely something, like you said, the promise that is made here is she's definitely in for some change. And she's in for some transformation too. So.
Right. Yeah. So we have two versions, and we'll put both versions on in the show notes so you can compare them directly. But let's talk about this third person point of view version, where we have it's third limited. So we're getting this from Abby's point of view. And so, what are your thoughts about the storytelling in this, you know, in this point of view?
Mm-hmm. So my first impression when I first read it was it feels somewhat distant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're in a third person limited, certainly nowadays we really like that close, deep POV. I feel like it should feel really similar to how close a first person feels. And this one feels a little bit distant. And I think one thing, a specific thing I noticed, which is something that, again, it's an easy fix too, which is great, mm-hmm. is how often the author uses Abby's first name.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, I counted them because that's the nerd that I am. And there are...
You nerdy person, you.
Nerdy person. There's 57 Abby.
Okay.
Abby first names. There's 57 in, well, this is 8 pages. And I don't know, I'm sure the reader could hear them, the listener, when I read them, they kind of start to stick out. There's a lot of times that they start the sentence And when we don't really need, we know that it's Abby. She's alone in her apartment, or she's the, you know, she's the point of view character. So if, unless we're saying it's someone else, we can assume that it's Abby, right? We can assume that it's, she is the person that we're talking about, and we don't necessarily need that first name. And because what it does is it separates the reader from the character. It gives that a little bit of distance. So it's just, it's just one of those things that just, it pulls us out just a little bit. And if we're looking to have a more intimate connection with Abby as a character and really feel what she's going through and experience the story and the scene through her experience and her senses and her mind and her thoughts, then any time that we can take out her first name and just put the pronoun in instead, or even a time when you can rewrite a sentence without the pronoun altogether, those are ways to close that distance and close that gap and put the reader a little bit closer to Abby. And so that's just one thing I noticed, that there was a lot of use of the first name. And it does come across, it makes it a little bit more stilted and it makes it a little bit more distant. So that's a quick editorial thing you can go through and just clean those up and look for ways to rewrite sentences without the pronoun altogether, or certainly without the first name, and you'll be that much further along in having a closer deep POV.
So when we were talking about this before we started today recording, you mentioned there were two scenes where we get visceral and sensory input from the story, but for most of the submission, we're not getting Abby's internal experience, in particular when her mother tells her that her grandmother has died, then there, you know, nothing happens, right? And that can be, right? There's a wide range of normal when somebody receives shocking news, especially if you're already feeling, you know, beat down by life because your boyfriend's been a real jerk. I'm just going to go ahead and take Abby's side on that. but so she's in a vulnerable state, and right, there's a wide range of responses that you could have to finding out that your dearest relative has died. And that might be initially that you don't say anything. But since we're in third person limited and we can be inside her experience, we want to know, like, what's the initial, you know, thought, feeling, like what happens inside Abby when getting that. And we don't get that there, but where we do get it, you mentioned there were two instances.
So let's do that as a contrast. So I'll point out the couple little parts that struck me. I put little hearts next to the lines in
Aww.
My copy. So here's a couple lines that I think do what you're saying. They really just bring us right up into her skin, right? And they give us this feeling. So this is when she's still at work and she's outside smoking with Macy. So it says, Abby breathed in the nicotine and then exhaled smooth and slow, as if she just had the best sex of her life, watching the smoke fold and collapse into the smoggy abyss. So that's just a little detail, right? It's just Abby, she's breathing it in. She's breathing, you know, she tells us how she's doing it. And, you know, it's that the best sex of her life kind of drag off of a cigarette. And then what Abby does is she's, you know, we get to watch the smoke fold and collapse into the smog. So it's just a little detail, but it's through Abby's eyes, and she's, you know, it's kind of how she's feeling.
Seems
the smoggy abyss, right? Like those word choices for feeling like, what is my life now? I'm in the smoggy abyss because I'm heartbroken, right?
And also that's like, it's almost as if that's a moment of refuge from everything going on. She is smoking a cigarette.
Yeah. She was just waitressing, the hustle and bustle of trying to meet everyone else's needs, right? Like everyone wants their check, everyone wants their stuff. And, you know, her boss obviously seems to be something sort of there. He's kind of a jerk. And this is her just taking a moment for her. This is some self-care.
We
don't advocate smoking on the program. But,
definitely,
you know,
not.
Some self-care. So her moment of just having this little moment to herself. And like you said, refuge. I think that's a great word for what she's doing in that moment, is seeking refuge. And there's the other one that I pointed out that I enjoyed, and I felt like it was a good intentional word choice that brings us up into that deep POV, is when So Abby's at her apartment and she's been looking at this bowl that they had gotten together and she's been thinking about it. And then Abby thought about hurling it across the room, the glorious smash that would sound, the pieces flying everywhere. And I just really enjoyed the word glorious there because I think, again, it gives us some intention. Abby is having a little fantasy in her head about smashing this bowl. And the fact that she says glorious smash would be like this justice, right? It's her taking revenge and seeking justice. And it's that like giddy, ha ha ha, I've done right. it. I'm taking back control. So mm-hmm. in a small way, you'd be taking control back of this life that has just, you know, sideswiped you and you can't do anything about it. And so just the word choice of glorious, I thought was really great there. Mm-hmm. And then to point it in contrast to the moment that you brought up where Abby's mother calls and she tells her that her grandma has died and you'll have to go to Florida, of course. And then the next line is, Abby, Abby, are you there? So apparently there's silence between that phone call. But again, there's nothing on the page. We mm-hmm. don't know what Abby's thinking. We don't know what she's feeling. We don't know what she's doing. So mm-hmm. there's literally no response from Abby. And again, like you said, emotionally, that could make sense. Maybe she's in shock. Maybe she's gone numb. Maybe she's, you know, her body has stiffened. But again, we don't know. She could have just disappeared. We have no idea what's happened to Abby because it's not on the page. Mm-hmm. So even if you want to give her a, you know, that kind of stoic response, you still have to give her a stoic response. Like you still have to put the response on the page that, you know, that her mind went blank. She felt numb. She felt nothing. You know, that was her body went cold. Her body stiffened. Her hand, you know, gripped that, you know, whatever you want her to do. But you can't give us nothing if mm-hmm. you're going to be in this deep POV, because again, it doesn't make sense. Like even if you act like those words don't process and I can't hear you and I'm not sure what she just said, you know, to even have an emotional response, you still need to put that, whatever mm-hmm. it is, what it still has to be something. So,
right. And the, I think you mentioned this earlier when we were talking about it, that one of the cool things about third person point of view is that we don't have the, and this is related to something Orson Scott Card wrote too, that mm-hmm. we don't have, when you have first person, right, the person is telling the story directly to someone, whereas in third person we are observing. Now there is a storyteller, obviously there's the author in that, but that person kind of fades away and we can get as close as we need to. Now you might be telling a story where you don't want to get so close, and as long as that's an intentional decision, then that's fine. But it right. feels like it feels as if the story that this author wants to tell is one where we get really, we are actually inhabiting Abby's skin with her, kind of, right. so to speak.
Right.
And, you know, and so there are these, you know, these things that can place us in there, and that we don't have the, you know, the fiction of Abby telling the story, that we're just experiencing it with her. And right. so that's like, that's one, you know, kind of, which is interesting, right? Because you would assume that third person would be more distant because.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because, again, it's just style. It's a choice, right? Mm-hmm. So you can have the third person omniscient narrator that is very much kind of almost a character themselves, right? Mm-hmm. What do we always call it? It's the Dickensian narrator, right? Like that's
right.
like. You know, is just delivering the story to an audience, much as a narrator would narrate a play, you know, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then you also have, and then in first person, you have the first person narrator who is delivering their own story in their own words. And then I think you can have this other thing, which is the third person limited, where it's the character is experiencing the story without the narrator, right? They're mm-hmm. really, it's just, it's the same thing as like if you were in a first person present tense story where the character is just experiencing the story in the moment mm-hmm. and you're just experiencing the story right along with them without that sort of you've experienced the story in the past and now I get to comment on the story because I know what happens, right? You get this mm-hmm. additional narrative sort of commentary Where if you're in, like, let's say first person present tense, you don't get that commentary. You just get the commentary as the character is experiencing it in the moment without the hindsight, right? You don't get hindsight. And then in that third person, in this third person limited, I also think you don't get hindsight here, and you get that same feeling like a first person present tense might feel, even if you're in third person past tense. It's the same thing as just experiencing what the character experiences in the moment as they're feeling it, as it's happening, you know, trigger, reaction, you know, and they're figuring it out on the fly, and we are just observing them doing that. And that's where you get that really close, that close narrative distance, as opposed to that the very far, that real narrative distance that has hindsight built in, or has another character telling the story for this character. So it's just interesting how those choices, you make those choices on purpose. And I think sometimes if people just fall into writing something and they haven't really stopped to think about, well, what choice am I making? And then how does my sentence structure, how does my word choice, you know, support the decision that I've made, right? Or am I being arbitrary in these choices?
Right.
And that's an editorial, you know, revision thing that you can go through and look at and tighten up that distance, or, you know, or change it, or whatever you're looking to do.
Right. And stories are so complex, and we can think, oh, this is just a matter of preference. And it is, right? People definitely have preferences for different points of view, and that's absolutely fine. But, you know, again, we want to understand what does this tool accomplish? So if I'm using screws, I don't want to bring a hammer, right? I want a screwdriver and that kind of thing, which is a really kind of a ridiculous, but that's the point.
It's so funny understanding, though, because that's exactly what we do with story. We think that, like, until you step back and really look at all of your options, right? Like, you know, whether we're talking about genre or whether we're talking about narrative device or we're talking about POV, whatever you're talking about, that you really do have options. You know, I heard a quote recently just from a local art instructor. She said, in art, there are no rules, only tools, right? And so looking at all of these things, when you're writing your story, there are no rules. There's only tools to help you accomplish the task at hand. So kind of going, well, that kind of comes back to maybe the why. Why are you telling this story? So this is what we would ask. We would ask our author here, you know, why are you telling Abby's story? And what about Abby are you wanting the reader to experience? You know, what, you know, and it goes back to the author's intentions, right? The author's intentions about the story they're trying to tell, the experience they're trying to give the reader, the theme they're trying to, you know, portray, you know, all of those things. And then you go, okay, cool. Well, here's all the tools that you have. Here are some narrative devices, like this framing device that she has, that she's used here, right, to put Abby someplace in the future and then kind of reflect back on how she got there. There's, you know, third versus first, present versus past, you know, distance versus, really close distance versus really far. You know, all of those things are just choices that you make then to support this purpose of why you're telling the story in the first place. And it gives you control, which is really empowering. And it's not about just having talent. Or, you know, I'm writing the first thing that came to my head. It's going, okay, I'm going to do it this specific way for a specific purpose. How do I accomplish that, right?
Yeah. So if we were to shift to the first person version of the scene, let's talk about that. Because we both felt that Abby's voice was clearer and stronger. And it was kind of a smoother telling of the story or of the scene. Yeah, in first person.
Yes.
And
yes. So, Leslie, why don't you talk a little bit about the narrative device at the beginning, that framing thing, and how you had mentioned how you thought it works better in first person than in third.
So
mention that a little bit.
We got, yeah, try to remember back to when Kim was reading, and I'll just read this little bit. Yeah. It's a little more, like I said, in your, it's a little more obvious, the framing story in this. That pendant, that god-awful chunk of wood that clung to me, cut me, stole my blood, and completely changed my life. It was my grandma's pendant, an heirloom that she passed down to me. I still don't understand how it brought me there, to those islands, those people, and those magnificent creatures. All I know for sure is that it brought me on a journey all the way back to the core of myself. Before I fell in love with the wrong man, years before I started smoking and guzzling wine regularly, and long before those mounting moments of self-doubt consumed me, leaving me feeling completely lost. My name is Abby Murphy, and about 8 months ago, I was finishing my shift at Dom's, a swanky LA restaurant right on the Santa Monica Promenade. I was attempting to get through my shift without thinking about Nick, the man who dumped me for another woman just 3 days ago and gave me a week to move out of his apartment. Dropping off my last table's check, I pushed through the back door and reached for my pack of smokes in my apron pocket. I pulled a milk crate near the ginormous ashtray and sat down opposite Macy, who was counting her tips in the cool night air. So in this version, we get a more clear framing story that the events of this scene happened 8 months ago, and we're just kind of, you know, more directly dropped into that. Because I noticed the third person point of view mentions this a little bit, but it's kind of an odd, like, it's an odd device in that context, or it's awkward. Here, it's like, okay, this is Abby 8 months in the future, or, well, this scene is Abby 8 months ago, right? Just after her boyfriend has broken up with her, and she's giving us a little, like, my life really changed, and we get her voice in the, before I started smoking and guzzling, you know, before moments of self-doubt consumed me. There was another word that I was like, oh, that's, you know, that's Abby. What word was that?
Interesting, because she uses the same words in the third person.
I know.
It's almost like it sounds a little more judgy, right? Like from a third person.
She's got more chutzpah than I feel at the beginning of the third person.
Yeah, and it's funny because she says, years before she started smoking and guzzling wine regularly, and long before mounting moments of self-doubt consumed her, leaving her feeling completely lost. But it doesn't have, like you said, it doesn't have the same impact as it does if you're saying it in a first-person voice. And so it's interesting because I feel like there is a way to do third-person limited where it feels very much the same. But again, it might just be because this is one of those framing devices. And it's a little bit, it's kind of summarizing, here's where I am right now. And then let's go back and tell the story. Here's where Abby is right now. Let's go back and tell the story. And it's just a little bit different. I don't know. It's interesting. It's interesting to look at it and compare and go, does this work? Or is this really accomplishing what the writer is trying to accomplish?
Right.
So when you choose a narrative device like this, like, what do you think the author's intention of putting this narrative device in here in the first place is?
Well, yeah. I mean, if I have to guess, I would write. Let's give the caveat that
we're guessing.
We're guessing, and that it is the author's point of view on this. You know, their reason for doing it. That is absolutely the last word. You know, so because that's the story they want to tell, and we can help them with the tools and that kind of thing. But we can't say, you should tell this story because I think this is better.
Yeah.
No.
But I've never written a story this way, right? I've never written a story with a framing device. I always start, you know, and I'm linear, I guess. And so it's interesting to me that they chose it. So I'm thinking, okay, what is the, like, why, and why would you use a narrative device? Because there's a reason, right? There's stories. One of my favorite stories is written this way. And so what is a good reason?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're at a different place. And one thing that we're going to talk about in a minute is that, you know, every moment is a culmination of all that has come before and a setup for everything that comes after. And so if that's the case, she has a different perspective 8 months down the line than she had in that moment. And golly, isn't that true? Like when something mm-hmm. happens in the moment, it can feel bad, right? Mm-hmm. Right in that moment, she's feeling really bad that Nick left her or kicked her out, however he, you know, she's feeling really bad about that. But at some point in her history, some point between then and 8 months later, things happen to her that she realizes, oh, that was a bad relationship. He was not good for me, you know?
Right.
And that perspective is a filter through which she views the whole thing. You know, okay, so here's a great example. I remember this from high school, which was a few years ago. But it stuck with me all this time. So you can, you know, get a sense of like the impact that it had on me was that the Sun Also Rises. Mm-hmm. Ernest Hemingway is telling this, you know, he's ruminating on the events of his life during that time. It's fiction, right? But he's mm-hmm. bringing in people and events and situations that he had been dealing with when he was living in Europe. Okay, so then, you know, fast forward, and I think it's A Movable Feast. Is that the mm-hmm. right title? I'll double check and I'll include it in the show notes, which is his memoir about the mm-hmm. time. Okay, mm-hmm. and The Sun Also Rises presents a very dark version of mm-hmm. those events, whereas, you know, with time, he's seeing those events a little more philosophically, a little less mm-hmm. dark, more like, oh yeah, it wasn't that bad, mm-hmm. you know, and that's just such a powerful demonstration to me that, you know, the events when you're in them or when they are proximal in time, then, mm-hmm. you know, you just see them differently and that you tell yes. a different story about it depending on where you are in relation to it.
Yes. Yes. And so I think the example that comes to my mind is a book I just read, In the Woods by Tana French. Mm-hmm. And it's a crime novel and it's told in first person from the detective's point of view. But it definitely has that telling it from this future knowledge, right? He's reflecting back on this experience and he drops hints along the way of, you know, when you're in the moment of the scene, you know, he's experiencing it as his character in the past, but then he reflects on it as the narrator. If I'd only understood what she was trying to say to me at that moment, you know, he has mm-hmm. these like hints that he has more knowledge now as he's telling you the story than he did in that moment. And it definitely sets up some tension, you know, oh, there's more to this that's going to come. And it's sets up, you flip the page, you keep going to figure out, well, what does that mean? What does the story actually mean? And it turns out to be, you know, something very important that if he had only understood what she was telling them, then he might've been able to, you know, solve the case earlier or whatever, you know? And so, yeah, it's just interesting how then that becomes a device to build tension, right? It brings mm-hmm. in some subtext. It brings in some additional things that make me go, oh, it tells me as the reader, there's more to this story. I need to be aware of it. And that's something that you get specifically because you're telling the story from this, you know, this place of hindsight knowledge and that kind of thing. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So, right. The bottom line that we were coming up with, right, is that mm-hmm. it doesn't really matter what point of view you choose. Sort of. I mean, there are, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages, and you want to understand those. And we've talked about those in another episode. And I'll find that for the show notes if anybody wants to go back and kind of review that. But the, you know, you want to choose the one that will deliver the experience you want your reader to have. And there are certainly yes. better combinations for certain types of story. But mm-hmm. it really boils down to this. No matter which POV you choose, you need to check your MRUs.
Which, yes. Put that on a bumper sticker.
Put that on a bumper sticker. Maybe get tattoo. I don't know. A t-shirt, maybe. Right. So, and I love talking about it because Clark is a big proponent of MRU. So I love that we're kind of pulling this in. And so let's talk about that. Let's break that down as Mr. Ingermanson said earlier. Right. There are things that happen. There are, you know, the stimulus, the trigger, some external force, something the character perceives happens. And then the character has a reaction to it. So it's a motivation, which or trigger, you could say, and the character's reaction. Some of the character's reaction is going to be inside them and some of it is going to be external. You know, it's going to be out that other people can observe. And some of it is going to be out of their control. And some of it will be a response based on, you know, reasoned reflection.
Right.
And those happen in a certain order. Right? Because you're going to have the things that you don't have control over are going to be the first things that happen naturally.
Exactly.
Before you get a lid on it, right?
Yep.
Then you're going to be, you know, having crazy responses. Not crazy. You're going to have more genuine in terms of, you know, like more primal. Like we talked about in primal, parenting, we talk about the three-part brain with you have the, you know, the reptile brain, which is like your brain stem. And then you have the emotional mammal brain, which is the limbic system. And then we have the prefrontal cortex, which is your human brain. And you react, you know,
exactly.
that order, right?
Right. That's perfect. Yeah. So even within the internal reaction, you have those, you have those three things, your primal, emotional, and then rational, you know, reactions.
Right. So the first thing that happens is you have feelings, and that can actually be, you know, it's an internal thing you can't control. That can be a physical feeling or, you know, visceral response. It can be an emotion. It can be a thought. But it's stuff that you, it just comes unbidden. It's the result of everything that has happened to you in your life. It is like what this thing reminds you of that happened when you were little or whatever, right? It is, you have zero control over that.
Right. Okay. So I have a perfect example for this.
Okay.
So as we're talking about this and the whole part of this MRUs is, you know, what happens internally to the character and then what they then outwardly express, right? And the conflict that sometimes can happen. So when you're talking about your initial feeling, the visceral response, your emotion that you can't control, you know, so like a fear response, right? If you have a phobia, right, you see an image, you see a picture, you see an animal, whatever, you know, for me, I would see a spider and, you know, I'm going to have a fear response. It's going to be visceral. I'm going to get that nervous system overload, hot, cold, head to toe, shock feeling, a fear response that I cannot, you know, I can rationally calm myself down and go, okay, it's just a picture on a TV. It can't get you, right? But my still initial, my nervous system reacts whether I like it or not. You know, I can't just, you know, I can't just play it off. I'm going to try. I'm gonna my response, you know, my external response. So while we've been recording this podcast, there was a little yellow spider.
Oh, no.
But so my internal response was, okay, you know, I was going to freak out. But because we're recording a podcast, my external response was, hold it down. Don't freak out on the recording. So, you know, I just want you to know, no reader knew that. And I played it really cool. So that's the tension that you're going to have. If you were reading my story and my deep POV, you would be seeing those internal thoughts and those internal viscerals while I was doing this. And then externally, I would be, you know, nodding and, yes, agreeing with whatever Leslie says. It's
interesting. Yep, yep, right? That sounds good.
The contrast that you get between what's going on inside the character and then what's going on outside the character. Right. And so sometimes they're the same. You know, sometimes you have a person who everything they say matches everything they feel on the inside. And that's a certain type of character, right?
Right.
And then you have this other type of character who what's going on internally is going to be very different than what they show you externally. And that's also a very specific type of person and very interesting. And so the tension and the conflict that you can create when what you have inside the character versus what they then choose to do and portray externally.
Right.
So just anyway, I just had a real world.
That's brilliant.
In my own skin example of the MRU with a triggering response reaction. So I thought I'd share it with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that, right. Once we understand how we have that, then, you know, like an example, oh, okay, that's how that works. Okay, cool. Then yes. You can begin to understand that for your character. And so, yes. Right, again, you have the first, you know, the automatic reactions, you know, that are, you know, essentially they're hardwired. Those yes. come first, right? Your
yes.
internal can't control them reaction, physical, emotional, whatever. And that's mm-hmm. all inside you. There may be some external manifestation of that, but that's happening inside you. Mm-hmm. And then you have the reflex, and this comes as a result of the feeling, and it is an external thing you can't control. So think about when the doctor hits that little bit, you know, that reflex point on your knee and your leg just kicks up.
Right.
That's a reflex. You don't have any control over that. It's going to happen, you know, because there was a stimulus, you're going to respond. And now, of course, this is not to say that you can just go about, right, doing things and, you know, use that. The criminal lawyer in me is wanting to caution you that is not a defense.
You can say whatever you want, but there's still consequences, right?
Right.
You can claim it as a reflex, but, you know, it has to, you know, a jury might not buy it, right?
Right. Certainly. And so, but in terms of your characters, you know, it's wide open. Okay. So then after the reflex, which is that external thing that happens that you can't control, then, you know, you get the lid on, your rational thought and rational action happens. And this is when you are back in control and you can intentionally think and do things that, you know, because you've kind of calmed down. Now, for some people, that gap is going to be pretty big. Between, you know, from the initial reaction, it's going to take them a long time. So you can think about that, like how long is that going to take this person to get the lid back on? And it might be immediate. Like I find those characters who, like, you see like a tiny flash maybe in their eye and that's it. And they've got it. They're back in control. They're obviously meditating for 2 hours a day or something. I don't know. But
we all hope to be as calm and put together as they are.
Right. Right. And so that is when you're working one way, right? You're looking at, you take the stimulus and you're looking at like what happens from a result. But if you need to have a particular reaction from your character, you can work backwards. From that, like, so you want this reaction. Okay, what's the trigger that's going to do that? And so I forgot to mention a thing. And the thing is, right, I did mention it, but in a different, slightly different context, is that, right, every moment is the culmination of all that has come before and the setup for everything that comes after. And so if you know what triggers, then, you know, then think logically about what is going, you know, what this character being who they are, how their past, what they want, you know, like what's their goal in the story, their objects of desire, the levels of conflict, their relationship to the trigger. Be that a person, place, thing, thought, whatever, you know, like you want to think about those things and then, you know, come up with a believable response. But you could also go from, I want this response. Okay, so given all of these things, again, the relationship, who the character is, their past, the levels of conflict, what is going to trigger that particular response you need them to have? Uh-huh. So you can work either way, which is cool.
Yes, it is. It's very cool. And again, it's a tool that you can use. I can work forward or I can work backwards.
Right.
One thing I was thinking as you were saying that was how you can apply this to your POV character and also your non-POV characters.
Uh-huh.
And again, it creates conflict because if it's not a POV character and we're only seeing what they're externally showing us and we don't get to be inside their heads, and our character doesn't get to be inside their heads either, there can be a lot of, you know, that's where we get misunderstandings, you know, mm-hmm. and we get a lot of this conflict and tension. You know, take Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy, right?
Right.
We only see Mr. Darcy's outward actions. We don't get to be inside his head. And so that's why we have a lot of prejudice against him, because he seems like such a snob and he's so rude, when actually he's really anxious and really uncomfortable. And he's just trying to put on this stoic front to, you know, maintain his, you know, his position and, you know, do what's expected
dignity.
Of him as a gentleman in society.
Totally.
But he's actually like freaking out. Right. And he's really anxious and he's attracted to, you know, this girl and, you know, anyway, just all that stuff. So I think that can be when you're looking at getting down to this scene level and you're creating, you know, conflict and all these things that you're doing in your scene, looking at that emotional set of the characters and what are they experiencing internally and what are they showing externally. If it's the POV character, you know, you get to play with that. You get to, you know, maybe have them, you know, be conflicting or opposites, or maybe have them be totally congruent. And then also looking at your other characters that are in your scene that we don't get to be inside their heads, and what assumptions is my character going to make based on their behavior? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, all of that stuff, just really getting down into that deep character level where you're in the moment, in that beat of the scene, and going and asking those questions, you know, trigger, reaction, and vice versa, right? Like, mm-hmm. my character is going to say something, and then what is that going to trigger in this other character? And what am I going to show or not show, right?
Right.
And you can create that kind of, you know, a little bit of mystery, some intrigue, some misunderstanding. And again, it's just a tool to use, but it really becomes authentic. It makes your characters very genuine and authentic, and we're experiencing them on this deep emotional level of human interaction
mm-hmm.
that everybody experiences. And so, yeah, so you can just, it's making yourself aware of it, that you need to pay attention to this level. Right. Nothing's arbitrary in your scene or in your story. So.
Right. Yeah. So that brings me to our editorial mission for this mm-hmm. week, which is check your MRUs. And so, again, that's motivation reaction units. And it's funny because some of the inspiration for this came from another thing that that Randy Ingermanson said. Is he said, my solution, so when he was with, who's helping writing students, right? My solution was to make them painfully work through several chapters so that each one was nothing more nor less than a string of perfect MRUs. After a few chapters, the technique gets easier. Then I maliciously require them to rewrite their whole novel this way. This is brutally hard work. But those who have survived it have become much better writers. I want to add like a maniacal laugh in the middle of that. Right?
Yes.
Because, you know, okay, so this is it, right. This is it. You don't have to do this mission. But I tell you, if you dedicate yourself to doing this, like really doing this mission, your writing is going to get better.
Yes.
So. Here's what you do. You can, okay, so if you don't have a work in progress, what I want you to do is look at a scene from your favorite story. If you do have your work in progress and you're in the revision phase, because I don't want to mess with your writing, you know, your process mm-hmm. and getting that down, then, but if you do have a final draft and if you have a draft and you're in the revision stage, then look for the motivation that okay. happens, you know, each motivation that happens. So that's the stimulus, the trigger, an external force that the character observes. And I want you to make a list of those. And then look for the reaction, right? What the character does. Can you perceive their, you know, their feelings and thoughts, the internal, that first level of reaction? Can you perceive the reflex, right? This is the external action that they can't control. And then look for the rational thought or action, you know, the intentional thing that they do when they're back in control. Okay, so you want to look for those and list them, you know, like put them together. Okay, and then again, like if you're having trouble like figuring out, like there's a reaction that you can identify, but you can't, you're having trouble like identifying, like what was the motivation there? You know, just work backwards. So after you've done that, if you're working from your work in a scene from your work in progress, then revise your scene or write a new one in light of your new understanding. Really nail those motivations and the reactions so that, you know, your point of view character, as well as the other characters in the scene, like it all makes sense based on what we know of the characters, right? Based on what you know of the characters. Because you can have mysterious reactions for the reader, but you need to know what's going on behind the scenes. So if you are not working from your work in progress, if you're using the scene from a favorite story, then I want you to rewrite that scene as if the reaction were different or the trigger were different. So you're going to essentially change the setup or the payoff, accordingly. You can change both if you like, but with your understanding of the characters, you know, rewrite that scene so that you get some practice in on writing those MRUs. So that's the mission. And, you know, do this one over and over again, like really get it, because like I said, it's, you know, it's hard work, but once you internalize that call and response, then your writing will improve like crazy.
Yeah.
Like crazy.
It's crazy good. It's very much like, you know, when we work on structure, right? It's it's the same thing. It's still structure.
It's still structure.
So it is. And that's so encouraging to me because I can do structure, right?
Like, woohoo, yes.
I used to always think like, oh, okay, I can outline, you know, I can make I can get a book that's working, but yeah, the line by line writing, that can get hard. And like, you know, because it starts to feel like it's supposed to just be this inspiration, like, oh, I'm just supposed to be good at using words, right? I'm just
right.
supposed to be good at making pretty sentences or whatever, being funny or whatever it is that I think that I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But this, like I said, is just one of those practical things that it's just about structure. It's emotional structure. It's the character's, motivation, or it's the character's response to this external stimulus, right? And what makes sense. And those are things I can control and they make sense to me and I can follow that structure through. And so, you know, once I have, you know, my global story, I've got my scenes are working, I have a working scene, then I can step into this level of, you know, beat by beat, you know, trigger reaction to follow it through and make sure that it makes sense as far as, you know, logically it makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, when it comes to like character blocking, let's say, you don't all of a sudden just have a character across the room. You know, you can follow those sort of things through, and emotionally it makes sense. You can follow those things through. And that's where you really start to hone the character voice, and you really start to hone that POV, and taking the story from, you know, that level of, yes, it's a working story, to this is an amazing reader experience. where you really get down into this beat level. And that's very exciting. It's so exciting to have a tool that I can use the same way that we use, you know, the story grid to help us make sure our scenes are working and our global story is working. You can use something like an MRU to make sure that your beats are authentic and genuine when it comes to the characters that you've developed. And that's so empowering. And I love it.
Right. And I wanted to say, you don't have to have every one of these, you know, like you don't always have to show, right, the feelings, right, the reflex, right, the rational, like you don't have to show that for all of them. But in the beginning, when you're working with this, do that so that you're getting the feel of it.
Right. I think because I think if you gave it all, it would feel very emotionally, it would feel very dramatic, right? It would feel very dramatic, mm-hmm, and this emotional ping pong kind of feeling. But I think what's really important is just to make sure that whatever you do show, that you show it in the right order, right? That you, mm-hmm, don't have us popping off with a verbal response before we've had the emotional internal one. Or like, you don't have to show the emotional internal one if you're just going to have them pop off. But if you have them, you know, have this, deliver a piece of dialogue and then think about it after, you know, of the feeling that they get, sometimes that won't necessarily make sense in the way that they're doing it as a response. Does that make sense? Am I explaining that clearly?
Yeah. Yeah. Another way to put it would be, if the first thing we see is the rational thought or action, then something else has to happen before they have an internal visceral response that they can't control. There would have to be another trigger because they're not going to move. They're not going to move in that direction unless something new happens. And that new thing could be like the tumblers falling into place and realizing having a revelation about what it means. That can be a delayed thing, but it's there. The revelation has to come.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So if you're going to admit them, then that's fine. But if you're going to, otherwise you would just, so your options in that specific example would be either just swap them around, put their emotional, mm-hmm, response before their dialogue, or if you want that emotional response to come after the dialogue, then you have another trigger in there, which could be their own, like you said, revelatory thought to be like, oh, I get what this means, and I'm going to react again, you know? And so again, it should always make sense, and that you're not just giving things out of order from these MRUs, because this is how people are. This is how people react, right?
Right.
And that's how characters react. Yeah.
Yeah. So a reminder, you can find the editorial mission on the website in the show notes, which you can find at writership.com/episodes. And while you're there, you can sign up to have the editorial missions delivered right to your inbox. So if you usually listen on the go, then this is a great solution so that you don't forget to do these fantastic editorial missions that will help you become a better writer.
Yes, I love that you apply them. I love this format, right, where we talk about something and you give us a specific thing to go do. I'm excited. I'm excited to go dig into my MRUs. I've got some revisions to do, and it's great. It's
great. Awesome.
Remember that the podcast is sponsored by Jim Kukral from the Author Marketing Club. Jim just launched his new service for authors called Happy Book Reviews. We all know that books are more high-quality reviews sell more copies. And happybookreviews.com is a service where Jim hopes to make your book happy with reviews. Check out the options at happybookreviews.com because nobody likes a sad book. And you can make your book happy with reviews.
Okay. Jim Kukral and the Author Marketing Club cover hosting and technical support. But our Patreon crew supports our time in preparing for the show. You can support us there and earn some extra rewards by visiting patreon.com/writership. The Writership Book Club starts this month for the quartermaster level of support, and we've just picked an anthology that I should have gotten the link for so I could tell you the title, but I'll have that in the show notes, and I'll mention that again next week, that we're doing the book club from an anthology this month. So if you're interested in that, head over to patreon.com/writership and join up, and we're going to analyze the story you know, at least one story, depending on time, and the scenes within the story according to the story grid method. So if you're interested in that, sign
that
up.
Great.
Other ways you can support the podcast, if you're enjoying the show and finding it valuable, you can leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher and share it with writers you think might find this useful. If you want to submit your 5 pages of fiction, please visit writership.com/submissions. Finally, if you want to show your support for Clark and grab an awesome course at the same time with bonuses, visit thebookeditorshow.com/potter, where you can pay what you want for a limited time. That's it for episode 115. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.